Hi, I'm Jeremy Kirk with Intel 471, and thank you for joining another episode of Studio 471, which is our regular video interview series. Cyber insurance is a way to mitigate the risk from cyber attacks. However, cyber insurance is very different from other kinds of insurance, say house or car, and the insurance industry is approaching this in really unique ways. With me today is Saison Seymour. She's a vice president and the head of regulatory risk and policy at Coalition, which is a cyber-focused insurer. Thank you very much for joining me, Saison.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me, you have a really extensive background in U.S. government service. Tell me about your background and what you've done.
Yeah, I spent almost 18 years in the U.S. federal government, most recently at the White House, working at the intersection of national security, emerging technology, and trade. As you can imagine, I spent quite a bit of time thinking about the consequences of digital insecurity across our infrastructure, and what that means really for the reliability of critical services like healthcare, which we see in the news all the time, energy. And that's really what led me, honestly, to the insurance space. Just to unpack that a little bit more, the last few years in the US have been a period of tremendous legislative and regulatory action, really, I think, globally. But one of the open secrets in the public policy community in the US is that our government has very limited authority to compel businesses to meet specific security standards. Outside of requiring reporting, there's really not much that we can do. And that was a little bit of a source of frustration for me because, you see status quo and something has to change, but cyber insurance can. And so cyber insurance is a market tool that offers not only economic and financial protection, but to get policy, you have to meet certain minimum hygiene standards. And in that way, cyber insurance can improve cyber resilience one firm at a time. And that's really how it landed here.
Yeah, and you were on the National Security Council working on cyber at a really interesting time. It was kind of like, there were three huge events in 2021 when you were there. There was Colonial Pipeline, JBS Foods, Kaseya, and these were like really watershed ransomware events that suddenly, us in cybersecurity had been watching this get worse and worse and worse over time, but suddenly now, with the shutdown of a pipeline, impacting food supplies, what would you describe? What was your experience there, during that time, and how did this, I guess, sort of push cyber as sort of a front burner sort of agenda to address?
Yeah, a kitchen table issue, right? I was there at the right time or the wrong time, depending on which day you ask me. I would say that, in thinking about how things have shifted, cyber risk is now accepted as a mainline central national security issue. And that's, I think, always been true in the cybersecurity community, at least for a very long time, but it hasn't always been treated that way by maybe other sectors and communities. And it was really a watershed moment, as you say, for Americans to see how the digital backbone, how it affects everything from their food to fuel, et cetera. So looking back, on my days as a bureaucrat, I can appreciate, especially now, that the way that governments view cyber risk is generally consistent with how we think about it in insurance today. And that's, in a nutshell, the state of our digital security is poor. That's true in the US. I think it's really true globally. And we're navigating really three simultaneous realities that contribute to that status quo. And if you think about it, these are the same realities that affect boardrooms, they affect the government, they affect insurers. And that's first that we have widespread digital vulnerabilities across our old and new infrastructure. And simultaneously, those grow by the day because we're manufacturing new products as smart, but not always secure. The second, sort of more tricky issue is that the majority of the infrastructure that provides our critical services is owned and operated by private entities. And the significance of that is those entities make their own investment, cybersecurity investment, and risk tolerance decisions. But the consequences of those private decisions are imposed on the public, as we saw with Colonial Pipeline. But those consequences are also felt by businesses, right, in the form of third-party risk and supply chain disruption. So that can get serious very, very quickly. And finally, criminals and malicious state actors just are going to continue to pursue digital breaches because they're productive. And that, in a nutshell, is why cybersecurity has sort of catapulted to be such a central issue. It's why I think it's much more a central business continuity issue. We're seeing a lot of attention to this in boards. And, you know, I think we're, it was a watershed moment. And I think this will continue to become an even, an issue with even greater attention as time goes.
So tell me a little bit about what's going on in the insurance market. I mean, cyber insurance has been around like for a really long time. I think like even in the 90s, there was one company that offered it. But this has changed quite a bit as sort of IR costs have increased and ransoms have increased and the damage has increased. What's been the trend over the last few years?
Yeah, you're so right. It has been around for a while. I actually learned that when I joined because it didn't it was a surprise to me. And early on, it was sort of an add-on, right? The would you like fries with that sort of like tack on to another policy. But insurance has had to evolve in response to digital crime broadly. And insurance is now, because of that evolution, becoming a more important part of the cybersecurity ecosystem. So the way that it's evolving is, you know, beyond mitigating just the financial consequences of an incident, the sector is also starting to move the needle in terms of risk management and incident response. So I'm with one of these insurers, Coalition, I would argue, is at the forefront of that evolution. So with respect to risk management, many insurers like Coalition now use technology to assess an organization's risk posture when they, at the time when they seek a policy, as well as during the life of their policy. And that's because we know cyber risk is dynamic, right? So we are continually monitoring our policyholders' risk, and we can even help them mitigate vulnerabilities that we discover during the life of their policy. So that's a very different proactive approach that hasn't been common in insurance until today. And because of that approach, the reality is some non-zero subset of Coalition policyholders just avoid incidents altogether. But beyond that, we're also playing an important role in like facilitating incident response, and we have DFERS, and the whole landscape is changing.
So I'm interested first of all, we'll get into that like just a bit later, but when you take on a client, what are the first steps that you do with them before you grant them a policy, or what are the requirements that those potential clients would have to meet?
Yeah. So it's super simple. We try to make it quite easy. We ask you a handful of questions for things that we can't see. But otherwise, we rely on a proprietary scanning engine to just evaluate your risk. So that scanning engine is constantly updated with honeypots, claims data. So it's quite sophisticated. And as a result of that scan, the policyholder will get a report, and we break out recommendations in critical high, medium, and low baskets. You can think of this as a roadmap to improving your security. You don't have to be perfect, but we do make coverage contingent on your closing critical vulnerabilities, because we know that even one means you're 33% more likely to experience a claim within a year. And that, so that's like in a nutshell, how it starts.
Absolutely. And, you know, when we spoke before, we talked about the sort of changing nature and hour by hour, whereas like there's good claims data on like how many houses are going to burn down in this neighborhood in the U.S. in 1 year. Right. And those are stats that don't really change. And I guess the risks don't dramatically change. But cyber is totally different, where you have somebody making a network configuration, or you have suppliers, IT suppliers, maybe making changes to your network. So tell me a little bit about how Coalition goes about trying to, I guess, keep up with that hour by hour changing risk profile.
Yeah, absolutely. This is honestly what makes managing cyber risk so challenging for insurers, and why cyber insurance has had to evolve. I'll assume that most of your audience is made up of technologists, so I'll answer through a primarily insurance lens.
Sure.
If you think of a classic peril like flood insurance, you will have several relatively fixed but measurable variables that fall within a policyholder's control, right? Is your home built on a floodplain or not? If you're, you know, beach adjacent, have you elected certain flood mitigations? Like, do you have your home on stilts? Do you have a sump pump? Things like that. Underwriters will factor in those variables and things that policyholders don't control, like extreme weather. So that's flood. But with cyber risk, there are way more variables, and they're very dynamic and far less transparent. So your attack surface can change rapidly, especially in larger firms, where people may be bolting on new functionality that your CISO or IT teams may not even be tracking.
Yes.
Add to that misconfigurations, new vulnerabilities in software, third-party risk from outside partners, and all of these like unique risks, like things that accompany like mergers and acquisitions. So cyber risk is hard is, in a nutshell, maybe the fastest way of saying it. And the way that we've adapted is just by issuing, partnering with our insureds. We issue customized alerts when there are new vulnerabilities, specifically vulnerabilities where there's a high likelihood that they'll be exploited. Because we're in the small, mid, and enterprise size space, we take on clients with up to $5 billion in revenue. That's really where we work. We also make like technical expertise available to each policyholder so that they can implement those patches when we issue alerts, things like that.
That's really interesting. Tell me more about your in-house technical team, because I found this super fascinating. I hadn't really heard of this before, but you've actually got real IT security experts. You're sending out, like you said, you're sending out alerts, you're offering assistance for patching, which is really interesting, because it, I mean, ultimately it helps Coalition to reduce the potential claims. But tell me about who, you know, what type of people have you brought in house and what do they do?
Yeah. So I'll describe what we do, but just like building on the flood analogy, what we do is the digital equivalent of like, if you were to discover your home is in the path of a hurricane, Coalition pulls up with a moving truck to help you move it out of that path. So we have all the people necessary to move your home out of that path of the hurricane. So we look as much like a security firm, in other words, as we do an insurance firm. So what I mean by that is we have all of the traditional irreplaceable parts that you need for insurance: disciplined underwriting, strong claims processing. But we also have this universe of technical expertise, as you say. We invest heavily in security and threat research. We have a team that runs honeypots, manages, improves our scanning engine. That's that proprietary engine that does your risk assessment. We call it Coalition Control. We do vulnerability and exploit scoring. We have technical experts to help you apply patches if you need that help. We even have our own internal incident response affiliate. So, you know, we have a couple of taglines in our business: protect the unprotected, solving digital risk. And our leadership decided really early on that we needed to invest heavily in security so that we could support policyholders to do that.
That's terrific. And when we spoke last time, we talked about Citrix Plead, which was a vulnerability that got quite a bit of attention. And then, you know, you were describing how you, once that came out, you went through their book of business basically to do scanning to find out if clients had actually had that exposed. Tell me a little bit more about how that specific incident sort of worked.
Sure. Yeah. So I might botch the exact dates a little bit, but it was last October. I believe it was October 10 when the Citrix Bleed, when Citrix came out and announced the Citrix Bleed vulnerability and issued the patch on the same day. We, on that day, scanned our book of business, identified those policyholders that likely had that vulnerability and began to reach out to them and made technical expertise available to help those businesses apply that patch. 7 days later, Citrix announced that they were seeing that particular vulnerability exploited in the wild, as they say. And it was about 5 weeks after that when the FBI and CISA came out with a joint alert, like noting how serious that is. So what that means, again, getting back to like our claims success, is that some non-zero subset of our policyholders likely avoided a claim because we were able to help them, alert them to the seriousness of the vulnerability and help them patch their systems.
Terrific. And you said like overall Coalition is seeing a lot fewer claims from its clients because of these proactive efforts. What's been the drop in, I guess, number of claims versus, you know, other years?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So the proof of the pudding is in the eating, I guess, is the quip. So Coalition policyholders experience 65% fewer claims in the market average. It's consistently between 64, 65. In a nutshell, we consistently beat the market average by a pretty significant margin, and we're very, very proud of that.
Great. And what are you observing around ransomware-related claims? You know, last year was kind of almost seemed like it was the worst year for ransomware. There was more than, I think, $1 billion in ransoms paid. It seemed like fewer people were paying, but also it seemed like some of those people were, it depends on who you talk to, some were paying very large amounts. And the attack frequency seemed to be going up as well. What are you seeing on your side from your clients as far as claims?
Yeah, so I'll start from like the macro. So in terms of overall claims, and Coalition publishes these stats in our annual claims report, so we do monitor the trends. But in terms of overall claims, so that's for all types: ransomware, business email compromise, fraudulent transfer of funds, et cetera. We saw an increase in what we use as the metric, frequency and severity for 2023 relative to 2022. So our claims frequency was up 13% and severity was up 10%. Again, that's for the overall portfolio. But just more granularly, the first half of 2023 was worse than the second half. And we saw a spike in that first half, mostly from ransomware. Ransomware is historically the largest in terms of claim severity. And again, severity is essentially a metric for cost. And I guess we saw a decrease, I would say, in the ransomware severity in the second half of 2023. And interestingly, over half of our claims in 2023 began in the inbox. So specifically, there were things like business email compromise, fraudulent transfer of funds. I think both of those were at 28% each. And ransomware only accounted for 19% of our claims, but they were, you know, they were pretty significant claims.
Yeah. And is that more difficult to monitor, I guess, help climb, I guess, you know, scanning and things like that? For business email compromise, it's often quite tricky because they're just sort of inside your email box. I guess, what did you impart advice to clients to, like, you know, sort of pick up the phone if there's big financial transfers or some of these other techniques that can be used to counter that type of fraud?
Yeah, very good. Yeah. So one of the other metrics that we have is dwell time. So what happens is it's not unusual for a threat actor to get access to your system and just hang out, right? So look around, look for the highest bills that you have, look to figure out who has the authority to demand payments or issue payments, and then sort of come up with a case. Even in ransomware, right? They'll look for your backups. If you don't have segregated backups, they'll look to see if you have an insurance policy, things of that nature. So one of the things that we say to our policyholders is, do not wait to call us if you see any type of anomalous activity, and you should push for a culture of security within your organization so anomalous activity is reported. Because the trend for us in 2021 dwell time was about 24 days, and in 2022 it was 42 days, and in 2023 it held steady right around there. So it stands to reason that from the point a threat actor breaches your system, you have some time actually to step in and try to either avoid the incident or mitigate it.
Yeah. I want to bring up something that's in Coalition's 2024 cyber claims report. And this is where Coalition talks about the dangers of certain kinds of boundary devices. You know, these are VPNs, these are firewalls, routers, anything that's on the network edge, because these are devices that are often attacked. And as soon as the vulnerability is sort of become known, attackers do the scanning, try to find instances that are out there. And Coalition actually named, you know, certain types of devices from Cisco and Fortinet and Microsoft RDP and kind of linked those to claims, which I thought was really interesting research. Tell me about what did you look into and how did you link that to claims?
Yeah, sure. So as I mentioned, we do publish these every year. And just so that people understand what they are, these reports we think are incredibly useful because they represent the results of public-facing systems, real-world systems exposed to real-world malicious threat activity. And we measure the results in claims. So in our 2024 claims report, as you said, we noted that certain edge devices were associated with higher likelihood of experiencing a claim. So just to put this in context, these edge devices and edge devices in general are important tools, as you said. But you know, a business has to follow best practice when it comes to updating them when there are vulnerabilities, just to make sure that they don't inadvertently become a liability. So with Cisco Adaptive Security Appliances, we found that businesses that had those Cisco ASA devices that were internet exposed were five times as likely to experience a claim in 2023. There were several vulnerabilities, just the background, were discovered in 2023 that likely contributed to that spike in frequency. And as we cover in our claims report, our security team actually noted that there was a particular ransomware gang that was exploiting a known vulnerability from 2020. And that, by the way, has continued into 2024. So second, with Fortinet, we found that those devices were two times as likely, rather, to experience a claim. And there were several critical vulnerabilities discovered with Fortinet devices that we expect will continue to make, you know, these a continual risk. Policyholders with internet exposed Windows RDP devices were 2.5 times more likely. And our claims reporter offers more detail there. But on the RDP devices, I will say that our research team found that there was a, you know, close to 60% increase in unique IP addresses actually scanning for those devices between January and October of last year. So again, taken together, just to put these in context, these stats reinforce the importance of secure configurations, having a patching cadence in place. Taken in isolation, they're useful but limited pieces of information. But over time, as insurers like Coalition publish this type of claims data, I think if you continue to see the same manufacturing devices associated with higher relative likelihood of claims, then it may be fair to draw some generalized conclusions.
Yeah, I was going to bring up, I found this like super interesting research because it kind of brings it full circle. And, you know, there's a lot of frustration right now with certain enterprise vendors and their products. CISA has been very forward in coming out and pushing its Secure by Design initiative and, you know, ensuring that products are, you know, fit for use. There's been discussions about holding manufacturers liable. There was the recent pledge at RSA. Many manufacturers signed up to Secure by Design initiatives. How do you think this is going to shake out? And do you think that, like, are your clients now making buying decisions based on, you know, number of vulnerabilities and perceived perceptions of perhaps weaker products than others?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll just say we applaud the Security by Design effort and the companies that have committed to taking steps in that direction. I don't have insight into what specific businesses, what decisions specific businesses are taking in response, but I do think that's really important information. And this is an important initiative. As I think we talked about maybe last time, today we place a disproportionate burden for the security of our technology on the end users of those technology. That's people and businesses. But, you know, those end users are often the least suited to take on that burden, right? So cyber insurers, this is our reality. We live this every day and we see and suffer the consequences of that every day. And that's why our model has evolved to be what it is, right? We share the security burden, alert them to vulnerabilities. I think over time, when there's more secure technology that shipped to the consumer, that will be better technology. And you know, the best offense is a good defense, to borrow a quip.
Absolutely. Cezanne, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.